The Movie Morgue podcast is back for 2020. And we just want to say a huge thank you to all of our subscribers, our patrons, our friends, and anyone who's been listening over the past couple of years. We really appreciate your support. For those of you who are new, who might be interested in looking for ways to support us, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/JessicaOnMaine. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it all. Thankfully, my mic didn't pick up any of my tummy noises, because my tummy decided
tummy
to make
noises.
Noise.
Yeah. Guys, gals, and non-binary pals, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess Whitmore.
And I'm your co-host, Annie. Yay, we're back for 2020. We're doing it all over again, Jess.
It has been a while. So, today, sorry for the delay, folks, but we had to take a special occasion for this one because this is actually a first for the podcast. This is the first movie that Annie and I saw together, as in, in theaters.
Yep.
I've been on vacation, I've been in Chicago for the last couple of weeks, and, no, it's been, I had a great vacation, and now I'm home and alone and sad. So, to make me more sad, we're going to talk about Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker. Yay!
Let's
directed
make all
by J.J. Abrams. So, yeah, very special episode. Oh, boy.
We had fun while watching it, yelling at the screen a few times, which also upset some of the moviegoers around us. But we were having fun. So, you know what?
Yeah. So, let us be very clear about this. We're going to rat fuck this movie. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, and that's an academic term, folks.
Oh, God. I have so many things. Okay. Before we actually get into this, just fucking... I was right. I was goddamn vindicated. Okay? Okay? Okay?
I don't know if that's something to be proud of, Jess. I don't know if you want that as a point of pride for this, like... This was just sad, and we're not doing this to, you know, dump on anybody who enjoyed the Star Wars movies or anything like that. That's not what this is about. I think this is mainly about us being deeply disappointed, not only in the films themselves and their lack of storytelling in a way that is competent and empathetic, but it's also about the reactions to it and sort of what they reveal. So, sorry, Jess, I interrupted you.
I'm just here to call J.J. Abrams a coward.
I mean, but are you wrong, though? Are you wrong?
I'm not. Why would you doubt that? I'm always right.
I'm not doubting.
Like, I was right about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I guess let's get to the review portion of this. Annie, why don't you go first? Grade this on a letter scale.
Well, thanks for making me go first. Thanks. You know, this one's gonna get an F, and it's getting an F because I'm in the mood to be petty. I'm sure that the real grade should probably be something like a D plus C line, but I feel like giving it an F. I am very peeved at the storytelling. I don't like that most of it revolved around slapping Rian Johnson in the face, and quite frankly, most of the way that the narrative unfolds in this story feels like it was just committed to death to me, like this movie was focus tested to hell. And I'm really glad that I was able to watch it with Jess, because I think without that, this would have been a really unpleasant viewing experience. Jess, how about you? How did you feel about...
See, here's my thoughts on this.
Whatever.
I would love to give this movie an F, but... since we're going with this kind of grading metaphor, I give it a D so that it doesn't have to repeat the class and I don't have to see it again.
Oh, that's a good point.
Because, no, honestly, here is the thing. I have had many things to say about this film leading up to its release. From everything from the script leaks to the rumors to just the announcements and the press tours and the dockets and everything. Here's the one thing I said as this kind of, I guess, anti-hype built to a climax is this is probably going to be the only Star Wars movie I see once.
Yeah.
And so far I've held to that. And uh-huh. that's honestly very sad for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like, I don't want to come back to this. I just don't. So, let's just fucking get into it. Because from the first scene... Okay, no. Let's just go...
You're going to go back to the titles?
No, we literally are, because the opening text crawl references a thing, and and this is the one where, like, it's been a couple of weeks, and I've actually looked at a bunch of the critical discourse, and I don't care. But one point that I think that was very good that was made about this is this idea that the text crawl reveals kind of the, you know, multimedia empire that this is relying upon and that it is a constructed and deliberate part of. Because it references a transmission. The dead speaks, Emperor Palpatine's voice, whatever. That transmission exists in canon. And the only place that it has been accessible to the public that you can see this authentic piece of real, genuine, canon Star Wars lore is in a Fortnite game. It is in the Fortnite Star Wars crossover event. That is the only place where you can hear the voice of the Emperor announce his return. So that's just a great starting point. Just absolutely divine. So, yeah, no, it's a mess. And I then the everything. Very next scene is just Palpatine's back. It's...
And not even in a way that we had talked about afterwards, Jess, right? Like, not even in a way that was clever. Just literally, there are tubes running into Palpatine, and he's kind of this Frankenstein-like monster. Our idea was sort of like, oh, what if he's a corpse that appears to speak, that appears to project thoughts into people's heads, but he's actually dead and somebody else is behind it. No! Palpatine is actually back, which I think, was a terrible choice, obviously.
Also, like, correct me if I'm wrong, I want to know how you feel about this. I feel like that scene felt like a fan film in the worst possible way.
Well, but I think there's some fan films that have been very competently made, and this wasn't even that to me. This was bad filmmaking. Everything from the really, like, slapdash dialogue and plotting to the just genuinely hammy cinematography using light and dark to conceal things from the audience.
It feels like a weird face double.
Yeah.
The lighting is flashing in such a way to obscure things.
Yeah.
It does not look like the Emperor.
No, it doesn't.
Did they get the same guy for it? I don't actually know.
Yeah, and they actually did.
It doesn't look like him.
I know it doesn't. So I guess congratulations to them on making their actor completely unrecognizable. Yay! The Oscar goes to...
Do it. Sorry, I have to.
Uh-huh.
Those are the rules.
Uh-huh.
This is one thing I will say, is this was my prediction. The second that Rian Johnson put, you know, Rey from nowhere, you know, just yeah. Rey, your parents are nobodies, is that this was our one chance, this is our one exit ramp for Star Wars to not be about the divine blood right of kings.
Yep.
And then they say, oh, we're bringing JJ back. And I'm going to go, okay, cool, you hired a coward to make a coward's film. So it's just, she's going to be a Skywalker. And I guess I was kind of right. But, like, you know, and, like, there was all kinds of theories. Everyone's like, you know, she's going to be a Kenobi. She's going to be a Skywalker, you know. She's going to be a Yoda. I don't give a shit. Like, it didn't matter. It just...
You know what the worst part about this is, though? Watching those YouTube videos with people's crazy fan theories about who Rey was or what the plot was going to be and whatever, that was more fun than watching this movie. And I say that as somebody who genuinely enjoys the new trilogy. Like, their stuff was more nuanced and thoughtful than the movie was itself. And that speaks volumes, really.
I do want to throw out a bone here before we go much further.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
I feel like if we just keep going, because, like, you and I have been having this conversation for weeks. It's been a while since I could get, before I could get home and we could get the recording. We've been engaging in the discourse and we've been reacting to the discourse to a certain degree. And I think, you know, if we come to this fresh, we'd have a little bit more to say kind of on a base level. And I want to say there are parts of this I enjoyed and there are parts of this that are cool. And I think that without, like, without me taking us there, we're just not going to go there. And it's going to feel like, you know, and like objectivity doesn't exist, but like, you know, it sprinkle a little bit of niceness in so people can see that we're not just coming at this with an agenda.
I mean, my agenda is pettiness, so.
Also, agendas are kind of good and are part of like how everyone fucking interacts with the world, okay? There's no such thing as apolitical art or commentary, you dinguses. Now, that being said, the force connection as physical connection and the kind of bi-location fighting, that shit's fucking great.
Yeah, I really like that. That was one thing.
And I do kind of like this evolution of Kylo Ren. I don't think it's where his character should have gone. And it doesn't play well with the overall structure of the trilogy. But this whole idea that, like, when you look at Kylo Ren in the first movie, he's like, you know, a neo-Nazi school shooter.
Yeah, genocide.
And when you look at him in the second film, he's kind of like an abusive lover.
Right.
And in this one, he is like a manipulative, gaslighting ex. Mm-hmm. And that portrayal is really good. The only reason I feel this character works at all is Adam Driver's performance. Like, that voice is fantastic. It has so much gravity. And without it, like, I would not be able to derive anything from this.
Which I think really speaks to his capacity as a very good actor. Like, he's a very capable actor, and I think he did a really good job with this character. I've also seen a few interviews of him on the red carpet where people are like, oh, people are excited to see Kylo Ren on the red carpet, and Adam Driver's like, I
have a name.
Uncomfortable. That's not cool. So there's really sort of the sharp divide between, you know, what the actor is doing to bring that character to life and how that character is being read and received by audiences and the sort of cult-like fandom shipping.
Also,
the
that
there.
Actually does that actually does play into like the reason I was so mad to begin with, because I think the first reason. I was like, okay, JJ's back on. It's going to be a Coward's Hill. I don't, whatever. But the second that we saw that first trailer with Rise of Skywalker as the title, A, I was mad because of that, but also because immediately before they had even done, and you know they were reshooting and re-editing and doing stuff with the script past that point, and the film did not exist in the completed form where you could look at it and say, like, it's got this solid trajectory. But the first thing they fucking showed in the first trailer was the reconstruction of the legacy Luke Skywalker lightsaber.
Yep.
And of the Kylo Ren helmet, which is a facsimile of the Darth Vader helmet. Literally, the two symbols of this dogmatic approach to the past and this, like, reverent blood worship of ancestors that were destroyed explicitly. Like, some of the most unsubtle metaphors I've ever seen in Rian Johnson's work. And they're just like, we can put some super glue on this. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, no one's ever really gone, Jess.
Shut the fuck up, Annie. Get out of my face. Like, No.
Yeah, I mean, those moments in the trailer were very much this kind of symbolic overcorrection, right? So Rian Johnson has gone and has arguably not only critiqued the way that film works and the way that the Star Wars universe works, he's really kind of besieged the mentality that J.J. Abrams lives and operates under. Like, Abrams is all about Spielberg and looking to previous directors for inspiration and studying what has been done in the past. And he has this kind of fixation on canon. And so when you see those moments in the trailer where Kylo Ren's mask is reassembled, it's kind of like, oh, this is not just Rian Johnson making a statement. This is J.J. Abrams now making a statement to people about what is valuable, what stories should be told and how they should be told. And that's really kind of gross.
Yeah. I think... Now, here's something I've realized. I have since become a little bit more acquainted with Rian Johnson's oeuvre.
Yeah.
Specifically, I watched Knives Out, and that movie was amazing.
It's fantastic.
I love it. I love it very much. It's a bit late to do that one now, but maybe when it comes out on DVD or something.
Yeah.
But my review of Knives Out is that Rian Johnson did the same thing to the whodunit that he did to Star Wars. And I think that helped me clarify my thoughts on what he specifically did to Star Wars. Is he dug deep and found what we love about these stories without accepting our explanations of what we think we love about these stories? Because here is my biggest issue with Star Wars, and I think I've talked about this story before, is back in the 70s, my dad was a huge sci-fi nerd. I've got a whole wall of, you know, like Greg Bear and, you know, what's his name? Frank Saberhagen and, you know, Frederick Pohl. Like, I've got all that sci-fi, like, I've got half that shit downstairs right now, actually. So when I was a kid, he told me, like, you know, oh, they referenced the Clone Wars. And, like, I had this theory back in, like, college where, you know, like, they cloned all the Jedi. And so you had the evil Jedi, and the Anakin that survived the Clone Wars was the evil one. And, like, it's a dumb fucking theory. It would make a terrible movie. But part of what makes Star Wars magical is all this unexplored space. It is this breathing room where you have this reference to a bigger and grander universe. Because that's the one conceit of Star Wars that has worked from the very beginning, is Star Wars has always felt bigger than the films.
Yeah,
very much. And the entire approach of the EU... Now, here's the thing. The extended universe, which they've mostly thrown out of canon, I don't believe in canon as a meaningful device. We can come back to that later. There's some good stuff that expands things in new directions, you know, stuff like, you know, the Thrawn trilogy, for example. However, there's also a lot of stuff that is antithetical or anathema to that wonder and that space and that breathing room. Because here's a hint for you, every single character in the original trilogy has a named action figure and has had, like, you know, 300 issues of comics explaining why they're really cool and significant. You know?
Yep.
And so we've, like, fucking Dengar has a fucking Wikipedia entry. Fucking Dengar. It's a man wrapped in toilet paper. Okay, like, we can't just accept that this world is bigger than that. And that's also the kind of approach that George Lucas took, and that's kind of what the fans demanded, is this calcification of this living and breathing space. It's like, you know, like, there's so many things. Like, so many people have said, like, you know, how Alec Guinness sold the Clone Wars as this thing. It's like, you know, this wistful look and this nostalgia and this wonderful thing, an implied thing. And then you look at what we actually got in Attack of the Clones, and it's like, okay, sure, okay, sure, whatever. That, okay, I can see why you ran away from that, because y'all fucked up, whatever.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I see is, like, you need that space.
Mm-hmm.
You need that space. Like, you know, another one that was going on is, like, this idea that, you know, there's this very popular fan interpretation that when Han said, you know, he made the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs, that he was full of shit trying to trick some dumb farm boy, and Obi-Wan could see right through him. But now it's like, no, you actually had to justify that. Also, the Millennium Falcon is a slave ship. Okay, continuing. Which, actually, by the way, extended lore universe, there's a robot that's on screen for, like, 1 second who is apparently inspired by L3's Revolution. So, like, I guess they're being sincere about having an advocate for droid rights, but also they're all still slaves. And so this idea that, like, okay, cool, we're gonna make movies. Okay, we're gonna make a Solo movie. Okay, cool. We're gonna see what he was like as a kid. And his dad dies, and he's very sad. No, wait, they didn't quite do that. We're gonna do Rogue One. We're gonna see exactly what happened before. And actually, Rogue One, I liked. Like, Rogue One, it plugged into A New Hope, but it wasn't about the same people.
Well, and also, it fit more squarely within the sort of World War II resistance film type genre that's distinctly about sacrifice, that's kind of showing some of the gray areas of the rebellion. That makes for a compelling story. The other thing that really frustrated me about Rise of Skywalker was that while this movie was out, I was playing Jedi Fallen Order, which is a very fun game if people haven't played it yet. It's enjoyable, but it's also kind of a compelling story about failure and being persistent through that and, you know, making a way out of no way. I really liked that, and it had some things to say that just seemed a little bit deeper than what we got in the movies. And yeah, I'm still a little frustrated with that, because I do like the films. I like them very, very much. But this last one, it didn't have much to say compared to Last Jedi.
And like, that's the one thing I want to sell is I wanted to like Star Wars. Like, here's kind of like my overall journey is, and like, you're probably going to want to chime in on this at some point, because part of this was this dialogue about fandom and about who is allowed to be the gatekeepers and who is allowed to be part of this community and this identity, not even, because Star Wars is an identity. You've got nerds and then you got Star Wars nerds. Uh-huh. And this kind of gatekeeping of who is and who is not an authority and who is and is not a true fan. Now, here's the thing. First of all, trans women on the internet already getting points against me because, you know, damn SJWs. But, bitch, I had the VHS collection, okay? The closest thing to the 1977 theatrical release that was available on home media, and I watched that shit multiple times a year for my entire childhood. You don't get to tell me I'm not a fan because I don't fucking spend money for all this EU crap. Do not fuck with me. And I wanted more because Star Wars has a very precious place in my heart. I do not come to this saying, like, I am here to destroy the nerd boys. You know? I do not come here with this desire to shit on this. I come here to shit on this because it has disappointed me. One thing I always say is that to love someone, or something, I guess, in this case, is to give it the ability to hurt you. Because if I get shot by some random guy in the street, I die, and that sucks. If I get shot by my spouse, there is betrayal. You know? Is the idea of reliance or trust or investment requires basically is vulnerable. It's this whole, like, paradox of life. Life is precious because it is fleeting, blah, 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 blah. But that is kind of the point. And I care about Star Wars. I wanted this to be good. And, like, you know, if I could kill that doubting voice of me and go into this with an open heart and say, like, maybe it'll be good, I still think I would have had a bad time with it.
Yeah, so kind of along the same lines with what you were saying, I also had the VHS tapes as a kid. I watched Empire Strikes Back all the time. That was my favorite. I also saw the prequels in theaters and stuff, and no, I haven't read the books and whatever. I have read a couple comics, but I'm not, you know. And to me, this whole gatekeeping and the fandom thing, Jess, part of what we were talking about before we started this episode, Jess, was your theory about how people consume media. And you were saying that for people, it's not about directly engaging with the media any longer. It's about being able to perform mastery over it, being able to do those kinds of gatekeeping things that we saw. Really, a lot of the same tactics that we've seen used in Gamergate, as well as a lot of other online social situations, I guess. I don't know how else to describe it other than a mess, personally. And so it was just really kind of disturbing to see all of the fan comments surrounding this movie for anybody who didn't like it. I was going into this movie very hyped. I was excited to see Rose Tico again. I was sorely disappointed. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
So yeah, that just kind of got lost in this. And for anybody who was saying that they didn't really like the film, they were immediately getting attacked with this idea like, well, you're not a true fan. You're not a true believer. And, you know, only true believers would like it. And it was just, it was all totally ridiculous and very surface level and really frustrating. Yeah. So, and Jess, you and I have kind of talked about this before, too. We understand that Star Wars as a kind of cinematic universe is, it's filled with problems. The racism, the droid slavery, amongst...
The human supremacy.
Yes, amongst many other things. Like, this is a very problematic universe, which a lot of us still love and think that there is something valuable and interesting in telling these stories within it. So if anybody is on that train, there was a most recent edition of Contingent Magazine that came out in 2019. They had a whole awesome series of incredible articles written by some very smart people about Star Wars, about women in Star Wars as archives. So if you're interested in that stuff, please check out Contingent Magazine. There are lots of people who have interesting and actually thoughtful things to say about Star Wars and what it does. And so for somebody like me who gravitates toward that, it is just kind of frustrating to see the fan discourse go the way that it did.
I mean, here's... It's... I don't want to spend the whole time talking about this film talking about Rian Johnson, but this film insists on shitting on Rian Johnson.
Super
and
hard.
So does the fucking marketing.
Yeah.
In particular, And I feel like this was very... There's a couple things. Like, the film itself definitely just kind of directly rejects any kind of thesis or exploration that The Last Jedi did. But also in the marketing, maybe not necessarily in some of the content, but the way that the media discourse was kind of phrased is, like, it's a return to proper Star Wars. In particular, what I was really disgusted by was this idea... There's a whole bunch of cast interviews that were all together at a similar time, and they were talking about how glad they were to have JJ back on board. And the way that was framed is, oh, thank God, JJ's back instead of Rian Johnson. Thank fuck. Where for basically everyone except John Boyega, it was more a question of, we didn't know who the director was, we didn't know where the project was going, and finally we have, like, you know, a missive from on high that everything is going to proceed and, like, it's the ship is no longer adrift.
Right, right.
John Boyega, though, was a little antsy about that. Something about, you know, screen time and his role not going in the direction that he liked. And I'm just like, I liked Finn in that movie. We've talked about this. But you know what? I'm not going to begrudge him that too much. Because what's kind of been fascinating is seeing, like, his interaction with the fans... What amazes me, actually, is just the entire cast. They are so done with these movies. You can watch them on every docket. Their eyes are dead. They are happy to be free of these contracts.
Yeah, and particularly Oscar Isaac and John Boyega have talked about why. So Oscar Isaac was somebody who was actually on board for the Finn Poe ship. He was very like, yes, Disney, come on, let's get a queer romance going here. We have chemistry. This is going to work. And the studio just flat out told him no. And I think he was just kind of disgusted by it and ready to leave. John Boyega has been receiving racist threats and harassment the whole time that he's been in this franchise from racist Raylo shippers. Basically, these people were really upset by the fact that a black man was in a primary role and that he might have a relationship with Rey, who is a white woman character. So there was that. And then on top of that, the studio basically deprioritized Boyega. There was kind of this initial start where people wanted to center him in the films, and then the studio just kind of cut down on his amount of screen time, on the resources they were putting into his marketing and stuff for toys as well as press junkets. And yeah, it just sounds like a bad situation all around. It sounds like there's excessive control on the part of Disney, but also an entrenched culture of homophobia and racism.
Definitely. And like, I want to talk about women in this series for a second. Because this is one area where they really fucked up.
But, like, real
like,
bad.
To an incredible degree.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm not gonna lie, like, a lot of people get very hyperbolic when they talk about, you know, resurrecting dead actors and the way that Hollywood has kind of managed this kind of necromancy and the way that that's kind of affected modern filmmaking. But I say this without irony, is they pissed on Carrie Fisher's grave.
Yeah, they really did. Like, I understand that it's a challenge, a very difficult challenge to try and do this when you have an actor who's passed away, but that tribute was just inappropriate and it was gross, and yeah, no. And to top it off, the rest, like, of the women.
Okay, so, like, let's look at our female representations in this for a second. Mm-hmm. We have Rey, who is now someone's granddaughter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not even going to shit on the concept of, you know, fucking parentage and lineage in film and storytelling. It's not even to that degree. It's to the degree that that's become her defining trait.
Yeah.
Which is, and it's the central question she's asking throughout the movie that she finally answers with, I'm Rey. Rey who? Rey McCain.
Oh, Jess.
Because let's face it, like, half that family is...
Jess.
I had to, because, like, half that family is war criminals and genociders. Anyways. So you got Rey.
Yeah.
Kind of fucked over there.
Yeah.
But, hey, she's the main character. Good for her. Good for her. She just gets shit on by the fans for, you know, stuff. Whatever. Don't give a shit. You have Carrie Fisher, who is made into someone's fucking mother.
Yep.
She was an admiral. She was a general. She was a leader. She was beautiful and graceful and powerful and different. And they fucking pulled her out of the grave,
yeah,
puppeted her to fucking Ben.
Yeah.
That's all she could be in the end.
It's real gross.
And I'm very mad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm incredibly mad about that.
Yeah.
And Kelly Marie Tran deserves a medal for even showing up to that red carpet event.
Oh, yeah. And showing up and looking like a friggin' angel, too. Like,
God, she was beautiful.
And all the stuff that she was talking about during interviews, I'm sure that I retweeted a whole bunch of this, but she was talking about how excited she was to see Rose Tico interacting with Rey, to see her interacting with Princess Leia or General Organa, and just all of that stuff got cut. And I can't imagine what it must have felt like to watch the final cut of this as her, because it would have felt like a dagger.
1 minute and 13 seconds.
Yep. That's the amount of time she got.
Out of a 2 hour and 22 minute film.
Yeah.
One of her only scenes is literally refusing the call to adventure. You know, no, I'd much rather stay here and work on the ships. And she is replaced by a goddamn slug. It's dirty. And I think the only other major significant female character is, I forget her name, but she's the one in the velour jumpsuit who is just there, just...
Carrie Russell as Zori Bliss, or do you mean, let's see,
Lupita, I think I mean Zori.
Naomi Ackle as Janna was also kind of important.
Oh, right. Well, we'll talk about Janna in a second. I honestly forgot about Janna, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
But Carrie Russell is just there to be a beard for Poe. That's all she's there. That is her entire fucking thing.
Yeah, I mean, that is her purpose. And again, I think that's why Oscar Isaac was so frustrated. And this is the really kind of upsetting thing about Disney, but it's also not surprising, is that for them, the idea of diversity and inclusion are really just sort of corporate liability management strategies. They are not as interested in giving platforms or amplifying marginalized people who want to make art. For them, it's more about including people so that they can make a claim and use that for marketing purposes, and that's just really kind of gross.
So, two things. One, I did not actually know Lupita Nyong'o was Maz Kanata.
Oh, really?
I did not know that, and I feel like that makes it worse. Because here's the thing, Annie, I'm going to say this, And I want you to unpack this for the listeners here, because when I say this, I think you will understand what I'm saying.
Okay.
Is, I think that's really unfortunate, because Maz Kanata is a Stephen King character.
Stephen King. Who tweeted out this week that he doesn't care as much about diversity as he cares about the quality of storytelling. Oh, buddy. Yeah. So Stephen King is one of those writers who tends to use long-standing racist tropes of Black people in his stories, and really has not dealt with that in any substantial way, likes to shoehorn characters in. So in that sense, I can see that connection between his characters and Maz Kanata. Kanata has definitely dropped in at times, appearing as a solution to things mystically. But Jess, what do you want to say about that?
Basically, here's the issue, is in Star Wars, there is a distinct separation between the humans and the non-humans. There is a very clear delineation between them, between their social roles. You know, this goes all the way back to Chewie and his metal, is they are secondary characters, they are second-class citizens. So the fact that Maz Kanata is this character who has this deep, you know, intuitive lore-like understanding of the universe and the characters and their motivations and their spiritual needs, she's a magical Negro.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, let's go back to Janna for a second. Not a fan. Like, Naomi Aki, wonderful, lovely. The makeup, the costume, the performance, great. Her role in the story is very troubling because it always goes back to skulls and blood.
Yep, have at it.
Because let me tell you something that is really bad in this movie. Because I was talking with a friend of mine. I forget who I was talking to specifically. It might have been Zach, actually. He was saying, whoever I was talking to, they were saying they liked how, you know, how you had this stormtrooper revolution. You know, this kind of insurrection of stormtroopers.
Was it?
And let me get to why that's bad.
Yeah.
Because in the end, it reveals that those stormtroopers are all Force-sensitive.
Yeah. Oh.
Which means that it is deterministic that they would be the only ones who would be conscientious objectors.
Oh, no. No, 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 no.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. This franchise just loves the idea of biological determinism and essentialism. It loves it so much. Ugh.
They are also, if you look at it, natural-born leaders. Like, you have this kind of sense of supremacy is, you know, you've got, like, Jedi as a modifier. You know, is you've got the non-humans, then you got the humans. You got the Jedi non-humans, then you got the Jedi humans.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, unlike the Padawan Force sensitive, they're just better than other people. So they are the natural leaders of society. Because the other thing that this ties with, and this is the part that really absolutely got me, is the fleet coming in at the last second.
Oh, yeah.
Because what that says to me is just, and I know we overuse this word because, you know, we're pretty left here. It is the most neoliberal shit I have ever seen, and I'm disgusted.
Neolib Palpatine.
Because what... No, because what that says is that the universe could have been out from under the boot of the Empire whenever they wanted. It's just a matter of not having the will, of not having the bootstraps. It is a matter of being ruled by consensus. It's basically a Gadsden flag, you know? It's just like, oh, it turns out we could have just fucked them all over.
Yeah.
It's a violent rejection of, like, any realities of dealing with fascism or with state violence.
Yes.
It's this idea that, oh, you know, we gave them the power, so that's kind of, like, what you do. It's absolutely not. I am just upset by it.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, the story has very little to say, and on the other hand, what it actually does say just stinks. Like, it's really, really fraught.
I mean, what I think of, like, and, like, I know it's the most trite thing to, like, take all modern film and compare it to directly analogously to, you know, modern, but we live in interesting times, so that rule can get fucked out the window.
Uh-huh.
But basically, what this says is that if our governors were so terrible, we would overthrow them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I mean, in a vacuum, in this kind of like vaguely political theory abstraction sense, it's right. But it is ignoring so much of the lived realities of the situation and the society and the power structures and the systems that keep us in place. Did you see that story around Christmas where some guy robbed a bank and threw up in the air and shouted Merry Christmas?
Yes, I did. I did. See that.
And what I saw was, there's a great tweet, and I can't remember who tweeted this. I'm very sorry if you listened to this and we stole your tweet. I'm trying to give credit where credit is due. But there was a line at the end of it. It's like, you know, a lot of people picked up the money and brought it back to the bank. And the tweet that I'm referring to said, Americans are the most housebroken people in the world. And ow. Just ow. Mm. And yes, and here's the thing. You can actually expand that out. And it's like, yeah, no, actually, there's reasons why it might be legitimate to not keep the money. Maybe you're caught on camera and you could be prosecuted, or there's some kind of liability for that. You know, there's a case to be made there. But those are the systems we're talking about. You know, is here's, I'm going to get personal for a second. I am much more limited and much more afraid and much more conservative, I think, in what I can do and what kind of activism I can engage in now that I'm out as a trans woman, because I am a more vulnerable member of society. If you are poor, if you are non-white, if you are gender non-conforming or anything, there are so many, or if you are disabled, there are so many factors that will limit your ability and will increase what can be taken away from you or what can be leveraged against you. You know, the fascists always come for me and mine first. And so this idea that freedom and rebellion and freedom fighting is this very simple choice, and that it's basically kind of a question of the power of the will, is frankly kind of disgusting.
Yeah, it is disgusting, but it's also what a lot of people think that activism is. Like, a lot of people think that, you know, you do activism and it's convenient and it's safe and all this stuff. And no, that is not how this works. Particularly for marginalized people, that's not how this works at all.
I want to talk about kids for a second, because one of the reasons that this movie is coming out, and this plays into this phenomenon where, you know, and it's this weird idea of, like, the human being is a self-repeating pattern and is this kind of mimetic ripple in the universe, to get really metaphysical for a second,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, the stereotype of, like, a Gen X, 45-year-old dad shoving a Star Wars VHS into his baby's face saying, become me, become me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see that, but that is part of a reason why we do this. And this is the kind of phenomenon that this film is trying to capitalize on. You know, the boomers and the Gen X, they got Star Wars in 1977. The millennials got it in 1999.
Yeah.
This one's for the Zoomers. This one's to make new fans, because those populations are going off. They're doing their own thing. And also, like, us millennials, we don't got a lot of cash, okay? Just
true.
But the whole idea is you want to create this whole new generation. And I'm just trying to picture what this film is like for someone who has never seen Star Wars, for someone who is trying to get caught up in it's the new Marvel movies or so on. And unless you were raised, you know, with the VHS tapes or, you know, with the DVDs, if, you know, you never watched Clone Wars on Cartoon Network or whatever the fuck, I'm trying to see what you would see this film as. And the thing about this film in particular is it's not catering to those kids. Like, you can say a lot of Star Wars is made for children. You know, you look at the Ewoks, you look at the Kenner, the entire Kenner space toy empire. But one thing I see here is so much of this film is contained only within the meta text of the Star Wars franchise as a whole. Maz Kanata holds out, gives Chewie a member, gives Chewie a medal, and says, "This is for you, Chewie, whatever." And the only reason that makes sense is if you've accepted, like, the, you know, the last 40 years of people going, "Oh, how come Chewie never got a medal?"
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The fact that there's a remastered cut which edits in and gives him a medal. This, everything in this plays to your nostalgia without being diegetic to the film. One thing I noticed really strongly, and this really took me out of the film-going experience, was how much of the John Williams score came out at these really unsubtle moments. Is, okay, cool, we're just gonna play, you know, the Two Suns theme. We're gonna play fucking Tatooine again, because we're supposed to be sad. Everything is just pushing the dopamine buttons for old fans. There is, I think, no consideration in this film for people who have jumped on at The Force Awakens.
Which, again, sucks, because in The Last Jedi, Rian Johnson has that scene with the kids at the end, and, you know, that's how fandom is born. That's how people become fans, is by looking up at the sky and, you know, emulating their heroes. None of that here.
This film does not, and it doesn't care about its new characters. No. It cares about Palpatine.
Yeah.
It cares about Luke. He comes back as a Force ghost that's the best Force ghost that has done the most direct things. You know, it, like, I think...
You're right.
When you compare, like, so especially compare him to Yoda. Yoda comes back as a Force ghost, and he does, like, one big thing.
Mm-hmm.
One big thing that could honestly be a natural phenomenon, and it's at night, and there's this mystery, and there's fire, and there's this warm emotional moment around it, and also, it's the goddamn puppet and not the CGI gremlin. I love that moment. And that really pushes the bounds of what a Force ghost is established to be able to do. Luke goes a step beyond that, and he's a fully fledged character in full daylight, just grabbing shit, lifting spaceships. It's no one's ever really gone. Fuck you, JJ.
I mean, even that line in itself, "no one's ever really gone," is a reference to another text that you need to have knowledge of before coming into the film. So, yeah, no, this is not built to usher in new fans. This is about fan service for previous generations. But Jess, I think we need to talk about something more important. You had something to say?
No. Also, just Finn and Poe should have kissed.
Yes, they should have. That should have been a thing. But it just wasn't allowed. It wasn't, because we can't have nice things.
Also, like, I think the other thing I'm seeing, and I'm going back to Palpatine for a second here, is this idea of the melding of the strategic and the tactical asset.
Okay.
Now, I'm phrasing this in a really dumb way.
Okay.
But who the Emperor is, and I think this is something that is a very common trend in media, but it's kind of like taken to the nines in this film, is this idea that the more important someone is, the more capable they are. Basically, when you look at who the Emperor is in the original trilogy, let's disregard the prequels for a second.
Yeah.
Because the prequels actually back this up, but I want to go to that. We don't know much about the Emperor except that he is the leader of the Empire.
Right.
He is a sinister, dark wizard who has Darth Vader, the juggernaut of the Empire, at his beck and call like a dog. And the greatest emotional journey that we take with him, the most sinister thing about him, is his manipulation and his attempted seduction and corruption of Luke Skywalker.
Okay.
That is what the Emperor meant to me.
Mm,
okay?
Yeah.
And, like, sure, he had Force Lightning, but that's, like, something that, you know, hurts one person. It's flashy, it's showy, but it's not necessarily, I think, the greatest power in the universe, right?
No, it's sparkly fingers. Let's be honest.
Here, the Emperor is a goddamn tactical nuke. Is this idea that because you are important, you must be powerful? You know, Rey and Kylo have the most force powers out of anyone we've seen so far. And also, just, this drives me nuts too, because, like, the whole, like, healing thing, that's going back to the prequel trilogy, the fucking tale of Darth Pelagius the Wise, of, you know, healing is dark evil Sith energy, blah, 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 blue, 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 blue,
Jess,
blue.
I love you, but it's Plagueis.
I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, Pelagius was a theologian, Jess.
Okay. I don't give a fuck.
Uh-huh.
I really hate this about this film and about this idea of canon and this idea of franchising and this modern method of consumption, because what this means is this retroactively detracts from previous films.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like stealing joy from the people who actually were kind of fans of this material, who actually like these stories. So thanks. Thanks, y'all. So I think one of the things that I wanted to talk about with you is sort of where Star Wars goes from here. Because as I mentioned before, it's not really as contained to theatrical releases as it may have been in the past. We've got games which have some really good content in them and some very problematic content as well. which we could talk about what Jedi Fallen Order is doing with women. Particularly marginalized women, which is not great.
That one's going to be all you. I haven't played it.
Yeah, I mean, you meet a young woman who is a witch on Dathomir, and your character, who is this young Jedi Padawan, who is trying to find out what exactly happened to the Jedi Order and figure out how to protect all of these young Force-sensitive children. You kind of bring her into your group, and then she's just sort of sidelined for the rest of the story. And it's kind of like, maybe they're setting this up for something else, but also, why is she here? Like, it feels a little lampshady. But that being said, the games are doing something interesting. The TV show The Mandalorian is doing something interesting and engaging. And I don't feel like at this point it's a spoiler for us to talk about the end of that series and the appearance of the dark saber. Where do you think this goes from here? Yeah, because you had thoughts about that. Like, is Star Wars as a giant media franchise, is it just doomed to repeat these same ideas over and over again?
Annie?
Yeah.
I have the most galaxy brain take.
Okay.
Star Wars is a Gnostic prison.
Ah! Oh, no.
You know I'm right.
I know. That's why I'm upset.
Because that's...
Oh, no.
Like, I just thought of it. I'm just like, oh, no. No, I hate being right. Yeah. Being right is the worst. Because, like... Star Wars is a thing with potential. It is a universe that is infinitely open and full of so many stories that I want to see.
Yeah.
And the greatest enemy of Star Wars is Star Wars. It's like this gravity well that it cannot itself escape from.
Okay. Yeah. Yep.
And like, that hurts. That really hurts. But I feel like that is... it's pretty damning.
Yeah, no, and I think that's right, too. Like, so long as it's toyetic, so long as it's marketable, you know, like, mass marketable, I don't think they're going to let somebody like Rian Johnson take over and tell the kinds of stories that we want. Like, even Jon Favreau's storytelling in The Mandalorian, you know, you had mentioned, oh, the Darksaber has appeared, which is, of course, going to make this a relics quest. And a quest for the holder of that relic. So, yeah, it is. It's just doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Damn.
The other thing to bring up about that is what. So I want to go back to methods of consumption for a second, because one, you wanted to talk about this, and like I've kind of like I've had a take about this, and it's kind of been resetting and resetting in my mind because like it's hard to slip this into the conversation. But specifically, we've talked about this on the show before, where we have this idea that when you interact with a piece of media and you can demonstrate your own value and your own kind of superiority to a piece of media, then you are free from this kind of unspoken understanding that by not understanding media or by not getting it, you are in a way, you know, submissive or subservient to it. And the big place I'm seeing this is in these kind of fan discussions over, you know, why this film failed. Because we've accepted, I think, as a general society, this film has failed. But you get people who are looking for meaning. And one of the very common things I'm seeing is this idea that, because they didn't write it out as a whole trilogy, right? This idea that they didn't pre-plan the trilogy. And, like, yeah, that's an excuse that makes a lot of sense. It's like, oh, if you had planned it out as a trilogy and you had one person in charge of it, then, yeah, you know what, that makes sense on a certain level, that would lead to a better end product and a more cohesive whole. And, you know, first of all, it's very strange.
It's the Kevin Feige method. It's the Marvel method.
Yeah. Although I will find it strange that all of a sudden these people are very much into a whole, like, you know, planned economy. But I'll let that slide. That being said, though, they are ignoring the fundamental. That's a good take. It's a good surface level read of why this film didn't work. However, this film could never work like that. And the reason for that is because there is a reason that you cannot write these films out in advance. And that reason is agility. Simply put, because this is a product of mass market capitalism. And yeah, we're going there. We're fucking going there.
Yep, do it.
Because of that, it cannot be set. An example of the kind of excesses of capitalism and the inefficiencies thereof, like the actual limitations, not just a kind of ideological opposition to it, is this idea that we cannot look beyond the quarterly earning. There's a very good example is that installing fiber in your districts or wherever as a telecom company would reap you, like, you know, very good returns after like the 10-year mark. But that looks bad on the next quarterly report. So no one will ever do it. And so there's this idea, and I've talked about this in a lot of personal conversations, is that no, you cannot write this because you need to have agility, because there's a couple things that happens. Your actor dies or is accused of being a child molester. You know, there's a lot of things that could happen. It's like, oh, okay, we have to write this character out now. Not only that, but you have to be able to respond to supply and demand, because this is not just a film franchise. This is a multimedia toy empire.
Right.
So let's say I'm J.J. Abrams and I'm going to write out my authentic trilogy. I'm going to go start to finish. Finn's the main character. He's going to become the next Jedi and he's going to, you know, escape the Skywalker blood supremacy, whatever. He's just a stormtrooper Jedi. It's the coolest fucking thing ever. Right.
Mm-hmm.
First movie comes out, we sell more Poe Dameron and Kylo Ren toys, and all the Finns are in the bargain bin. I have just fucked the entire trilogy. Is you need to be able to react to material circumstances and also to feedback. In a way, it is kind of this dearth and death of filmmaking where it is reactive to a focus testing group and to this kind of tyranny of the audience.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really insightful reading, I think.
Yeah. And so, like, yes, sure, here is your reason why you think, oh, you could have done it better because you would have written out in advance, because you're not understanding the societal pressures and the systems that created this film.
And you're also not understanding your own complicity within those systems, right? Like, you're not even understanding your own role within that.
Yeah. It's a mess.
Damn.
It always has been.
Yeah. No, it definitely always has been, but I think that that's a really good point.
Like, and I think this is kind of, I think you could, honestly, looking at Star Wars as a whole, mm-hmm. you can kind of see this very interesting kind of meta story going around. The first three films are made on these shoestring budgets, and they're these artist passion projects where you're fighting the studios at every turn, and it's this runaway, breakaway success that no one expected to survive. And that's part of the reason that it became an empire is because, you know, they, some would say foolishly, gave away the toy rights and all that jazz. Not gonna get into the kind of moral judgments of that. I don't care. But what happens next is you get the prequel trilogy, where George Lucas is the greatest film auteur ever made. No one will ever say no to him. All these limitations that he had to deal with budget, with producers, no one can say no to George. Are you going to be the fucking production assist? Are you going to be the producer that tells George Lucas, inventor of Star Wars, that he can't have a giant fuzzy rabbit character? Oh. The man made Star Wars, you idiot.
Oh, boy.
You know?
Yeah.
That's just what we got to deal with. And when we got this kind of auteur vision, there are elements of it that I like, and there's some things that it tried that it didn't necessarily succeed at that were interesting in and of itself. I'm not going to denigrate them as a product as a whole. But you have scrappy product. Mm-hmm. You have, what's the word I'm looking for here? You have a juggernaut auteur.
Yeah.
And now, finally, we've come all the way and it's fully metastasized into a corporately owned product. Because here's the thing. Star Wars, I don't like calling this any kind of moral victory for it because of, you know, my own personal beliefs about capitalism and all that. But it was privately owned, and that's something I think you could take some pride in. It was an empire, but it was an empire that belonged to Lucas. And now it belongs to a board of directors.
Mm.
And that's what the films are.
Because,
you could have written these out to go to the central point. And that's kind of what the prequel trilogy did. And we all saw how well that worked out.
Oh, the prequels.
We gotta do some more of those.
We do have to do some more of those. We really do. Because I just rewatched some of them. And man, that is a freight train that's on fire, but it is really interesting.
And honestly, give me interesting.
Yes. At least give us interesting. Don't give us focus-tested storytelling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think kind of the last thing I want to talk about. I was talking with some friends earlier on Discord, and they posted an article about some talking head. I forget who it was, but they said, like, you know, should we have a female James Bond? It's like, no, let women, like, develop their own series and make their own characters that, you know, people can come fall in love with and blah, 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 blah. And I agree with that point in a vacuum. But the issue is that relies on the conceit that we live in any kind of functioning meritocracy. And we don't, because we had Atomic Blonde. We had Red Sparrow.
We also have Killing
Black
Eve.
Widow.
We have Killing Eve. Yeah.
And what we've come to is this idea that, yeah, we can build our own spaces and we can build our own franchises and our own memories and our own characters and our own universes, and they will not get any of the respect or the prestige or the coverage or the money that the quote-unquote real ones do. Because the question of power and the question of prestige is not a question of merit. It is not a question of quality. It is a question of inertia. It is a question of systems. And it is a question, of connection. It is a question of what is, not what can be. And so this idea that, like, you know, oh, the SJWs are ruining Star Wars. It's like, first of all, no, this is corporate. This is the most safe milquetoast film. Congratulations, white supremacists. Y'all been left behind. You are not a market worth catering to. But even within that concept, looking at this idea of, like, you know, make your own thing. It's like, no, because the only thing we will be making is Star Wars. The year is 2042, and there are only 7 film franchises. We got Fast and Furious 32. We got Star Wars Episode 17. We have Gone with the Wind 15, Electric Boogaloo, and that's all that film will be. That's all that film will be, because we are destroying the mid-range studio, we are destroying the auteur. Quentin Tarantino will make a cinematic universe because they'll have his head in a fucking jar. This is where we're going.
Yeah, no, I...
Because you don't go to see independent films. You don't go to see fucking Proud Mary. You just go to see fucking Star Wars. You go to see fucking the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This idea that, like, original films don't break the bank. And the amount of money in Hollywood is destroying Hollywood.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think we're in a bubble. And, like, it's going to take a long time to pop because there is no, like, meaningful alternative. But I do think ultimately this is, like, the most distended and engorged and disgusting bubble we've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the bubble is far off from popping. I think it actually has been popping, but just kind of like a slow leak, if you will, since the 1980s. There are thousands of movie theaters across the country that have been shutting down. And I have to say, to kind of add further dimension to what you're saying, I think that part of the problem is that people are not going to see independent movies. I also think that there are serious issues with systemic social and economic inequality that are preventing people from enjoying art that is on a smaller scale. And I think a lot of people are spending their money, you know, to take their family out and stuff, to things like that. So you kind of have all of these problems that are bound up in the same systems, the same things that are causing these cascading failure in the arts to create actual equitable platforms for people to tell these stories. And that's really frustrating. And it's just, the experience of watching Star Wars this time was frustrating because I think both you and I were coming to sort of understand this, if we hadn't already. This was just kind of the nail in the coffin. Like, this was the crystallization of that for us.
Yeah, here's kind of my piece on this whole phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Because one thing I've noticed is, and, like, I am not the canary in the coal mine. I am not the average consumer. I do not speak for the trees or for the people. But me, personally, I have given less. I have never given as little as a shit as I have about new releases as I have in these last, like, 3 years. Literally, the only films I am excited for, like, Sight Unseen, are Ari Aster. Anything he does, just because the man is terrifying. But also anything A24 produces. Anything Guillermo del Toro produces. Those are these very limited sets of joy. And everything else feels so bombastic and so produced that I genuinely don't care. Jumanji was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, it was quite enjoyable.
But, you know, I'm speaking strictly about the first one. I have not seen the sequel. We might see that, do that. I'm not sure yet at this point. But it's a pleasant surprise. But even so, you look at that film, you have Karen Gillan, you have Kevin Hart,
you have The Rock.
Like, this cute little, this film that honestly I think, on this kind of like, level of engagement that I think would be more honest and open to finding this, discovering this, and coming to love it organically is corrupted by, yeah, but we have to bank it with all these big stars. And I don't think you have as many people with these kind of niche appeals anymore. Is the way we consume and the way we market has really radically altered the landscape in a way that I think is just gnarly. So there we go. I went from, you know, Star Wars bad to the death of film. Congratulations. Oh. These are the kind of takes we're going with today.
Well, but it's important to talk about this, right? Like, I think most people know that Disney, as a studio, has basically a mega monopoly over the entertainment industry right now. They've got a streaming service. They have all those movie studios within their house. They have all of these different properties that they're running all at the same time. They've got everything. And so it's really important for people to engage with the media that they're producing very directly and to understand how the filmmaking process works now, because it's changing the way we watch films. It's changing the kinds of films that we see. It's changing the stories that we see brought on screen. And it's really kind of delimiting a lot of the possibilities for equitable forms of representation. And I don't think people realize that yet. So I hope that we get to that point soon, but who knows?
I have one final closing comment.
Close away.
It is amazing to me. First of all, like, it's this weird double wave that happened with The Last Jedi. Because on one level, people really hated what it said.
Mm-hmm.
But on another level, it amazes me because we've come back to shit on Rian Johnson. But before that, they found a woman to blame.
Yep.
You know, they shit all over Kathleen Kennedy. Yep. And here's the thing. Kathleen Kennedy is one of the most successful and influential producers in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
She's a successful woman in her own regard. And frankly, like, a lot of these people who just kind of turned on her and said, like, oh, you ruined the franchise by injecting your SJW politics, blah, 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 are idiots who don't deserve to share a breath with her. However, self-fulfilling prophecy, because she let JJ back on board,
She
became a coward.
Mm-hmm.
That's my closing statement. Because honestly, this is something I've realized in, like, this whole journey I've taken in discovering, like, a critical engagement with media, is that directors are dead, producers are king. Producers are the only one with any creative control.
Oh, yeah. No, this is the age of producers. Yeah. What?
Yeah. And I think I first started coming up with that idea when I was looking at reality TV. Not, like, back during, like, the Writers Guild strike or anything, but, like, recently, is realizing the realities of how the characters, the contestants, nothing matters except a smart producer. Because, like, we live in this era where, capital and production companies and everything is fluid. All you need to do is to be able to sell something and to be able to cobble together the pieces of what works together. So, ultimately, in a film as capitalistically nightmarish and twisted and disgusting as this, the blame has to go to the producer. So, I guess congratulations, angry Star Wars nerds. You got one right, sort of. Any closing thoughts, Annie? I've talked a lot.
I mean, I don't really have anything profound to say at this point. I guess if there's one thing I could leave people with, though, it's something that we've talked about before. Support independent creatives. If you have, you know, people whose work you really like, I don't care whether it's a webcomic, whether it's drawings or animations, whether it's fan fiction or fan films, if you know of somebody whose work you really like, support them, and not just with money, with words. Tell them what you like about their work. Tell them that you value their voice. Tell them that stuff. That's going to be super important, particularly for artists who are struggling in this market. in 2020, we really need to be there for our artist friends, because with a studio system like this, it is going to become tougher and tougher for independent creatives.
How weird is it that those fucking marketing gurus from like 2007 turned out to be right? That we've got thought leaders and thought followers?
I don't know that it's that weird. I think that's just how hegemony works. So
we live in a society.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. This has been the Movie Morgue, the Premier Movie Autopsy Podcast.
Welcome back.
I've been your host, Jess Whitmore. You guys can follow us on Twitter at Movie Morgue Cast. You can find us or on iTunes or wherever podcasts are sold. Don't buy podcast, kids. This one's supposed to be free. That being said, if you want to support us, can help us keep the lights on, get us movie tickets, because I had to see this one in America. Tickets are a lot more expensive there. Keep us in, you know, servers and celluloid. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/JessicaOnMain. That's all one word. And, yeah, but thank you so much. I'm Jessica. You guys can follow me on Twitter at JessicaOnMain, all one word. And Annie, where can people find you and your lovely dog?
People can always find me on Twitter as well as on the Discord. On Twitter, you can find me at AnnieProducer. That's where I am. Sometimes I tweet pictures of my dog, very rarely. A lot of times I'm tweeting other critics that I think people should follow, because they have lots of cool things to say. Yeah.
Yeah. And our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factopus. Find a link to their EP down below in the show notes. And thank you guys so much. It's good to be back.
Oh, yes,
we'll catch you next time. We love you all. Bye-bye.
Bye. Boop.